Okay, so this morning I've got a koan for you from the Book of Equanimity. This is a copy of the Book of Equanimity. There's quite a few translations about. This is by Gary Chinwick Wick, and he also wrote a commentary on this as well. It's a bit of a doozy of a koan, I must say. When I first chose this koan, well, actually, as I say to you, except for Koan Mu, I normally don't choose koan. I just open up and there it is. And I thought, oh, no, not that one. when I got this koan. But the trick is, it's not even a trick, but the task is to really penetrate it. And usually if there is resistance, that means there's some stuff there that maybe we haven't penetrated. We might be bored with it, or we might think, oh, I've done this again, or I've done that before. But nevertheless, you know, it's, to me anyway, it's a signal that there's some resistance there towards it. Anyway, I had this very much with this koan. I just want to tell you this. But having persisted with it, I got a lot out of it. Even though when I first looked at it, I thought, oh gosh, you know, this is a doozy. So anyway, I'd like to read the koan out, the introduction out, and the verse. So in this particular situation, we only deal with the case in the Dokusan room, okay? Not the introduction and the verse, but the introduction and the verse in many ways can give us hints of what the case is all about. And if we persist with them and really study a koan, you know, like they have traditionally done in the Rinzai way, it is a surprise how rich these commentaries are and how rich the verses are. The commentary, or I should say the introduction in this case, called an introduction, and the verses were written by different people in this case. I'll go over that in a minute. But let me just read it out. Introduction. Even if you sank forever in hell, you would not look for the liberation of the saints. Devadatta enjoyed the bliss of the third dhyana heaven amid uninterrupted hell. Udaka Ramaputta fell from the zenith of heaven down into the body of an otter. Just tell me, where is the gain or loss? The case. When Uncle Mishi and Tozan were walking together, they saw a white rabbit running in front of them. Mishi said, "How swift!" Tozan said, "In what way?" Mishi said, "It is just like a person in white clothes being venerated as prime minister." Tozan said, "You are such an elderly and respectable man, and still you say something like that?" Mishi said, "Then how about you?" Tozan said, "A noble of an ancient house is temporarily fallen into poverty." The verse. Matching strength with snow and frost, walking smoothly upon elevated clouds. Xia Hui left his country, Xian Ru passed the bridge. Xiao and Chao's strategy established the Han dynasty. The body and mind of Chao and Zhu wanted to evade Emperor Yao. People are disturbed by favor and disgrace. Find deep faith in yourself. The traces of the true heart get mingled and mixed with those of fishermen and woodcutters. So you know what I mean. It's one of those where you go, oh no, next. And you turn the page, you know. And it's interesting, contrast this koan with a koan like from Joshu. You know, even Joshu's Mu. Does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Mu. Or another monk asked Joshu, what is the meaning of the Bodhidharma coming from the West? Or what is the meaning of Buddhism? And Joshu's answer was an oak tree in the garden. So these are completely different presentations, you know. So it's really, you know, it's really interesting to contrast them, and we'll go through that in a minute, a little bit. But before I go into the guts of the koan, if you like, I'd just like to remind people of something, and it's something that I haven't spoken about a lot, and it's become apparent again doing Dokusan just recently, doing this session. First of all, what we do in Zen is called koan introspection. So that is one of the practices I talked about in the beginning. We have different practices in Zen, one of which is koan introspection. Okay. So koan introspection is a wisdom practice. Remember that we have, if you like, in Zen, we have three methods that we teach. The first one is sila, which is ethics, morality, virtue. Okay, we read the precepts every time or before we have a sit, you know. So all the students are encouraged to read precepts before they sit every day. You know, that instills in us some, you know, some way of looking at the world through the eyes of the values that we have. And the values that we have are embodied in the precepts. The second one is samadhi, or concentration. So we practice our Zen in order to develop concentration so that we don't get carried away with the monkey mind, so that we don't get carried away with the chain, with the linking of all the thoughts. We don't just get trapped in that. Concentration is the power to discern when we are being in a state that carries us away without us having any influence over it. Concentration is really important. And the other one is wisdom. Wisdom has got different names. Okay, so one of the words that we, of course, is prajna. Like we recite the prajna paramita. There's a paramita and then there's prajna. You know, another word for wisdom is insight. We get insight. Okay, and another word for wisdom is also, for those of you that are practicing vipassana, is vipassana. Vipassana is nothing. Vipassana means seeing things as they are. That's vipassana, seeing things as they are, and that is wisdom, to see things clearly without the overlays of concepts, without the overlays of our monkey mind. So we are reducing whatever we see, including phenomena, down to its purest wisdom, and that's the practice we do with koans. We have to start looking at it and all of a sudden start discriminating away all the overlays, all that stuff that, you know, our mind looks at normally, and get to the heart of it. The heart of the koan we've got to find. Okay. And the more distracted our mind is, the more difficult it is to find that. That's why it's so difficult to find mu. What is mu? In order to find mu, we need to let go of everything. Kill the Buddha, remember? Once that letting go has happened, it opens up. We see it for what it truly is. That is vipassana. That is vipassana practice. That is wisdom practice. So once we've got that glimpse, if you like, once we've got that glimpse that we get through samadhi, you know, that opens up. So when you look at sila, samadhi, prajna, or virtue, there's different names for it. Virtue, ethics, whatever you want to call it, you know, concentration and wisdom, they interrelate. They are not separate. Really important to get that. And I'll give you an example. If you have morality or the precepts without wisdom, it becomes fundamentalism. Very dangerous. Very dangerous. You need wisdom in morality. Okay. You need concentration there as well. Because if you haven't got the concentration, you don't see when it's right or wrong in your own head. You're carried away and you just all of a sudden react in anger and you kill someone. We see people that have reacted like that in prisons all the time. So both concentration and wisdom is important. To realize virtue, the virtue of it. Now look at concentration. Concentration on its own, also very dangerous. You know, because concentration on its own is learning, for instance, a marksman shoots. There's no wisdom there, they just kill. You need wisdom as a marksman too. Am I doing the right thing here by killing? Of course, you concentrate. The practice of concentration on its own without those other elements, you know, is very dangerous. So concentration on its own also needs some sense of moral discrimination. If we don't have a moral discrimination in our concentration, it's just, again, dangerous. And we have seen many examples, including in the Zen tradition, in every Buddhist tradition, where people get carried away with the emptiness of it all. You can still get to all the levels of concentration without having wisdom and without having any moral compass, because it's just a practice that we can teach ourselves. But without that, it's certainly not Buddhism, because those three elements are the elements of the Eightfold Path: ethics, concentration, wisdom. They are the three elements of the Eightfold Path. We practice them. Once we practice them, once as a method, those path elements will automatically fall into place. We don't have to worry about it, you know. But that combination is important. Now let's look at wisdom. Wisdom practice is what we do when we practice koans. Wisdom practice needs concentration, you know, and it needs ethics. It needs a moral. We need again to have a moral compass in order to see wisdom practice, you know. If we don't have that, wisdom doesn't arise. It's just pure concentration without any discrimination. You know. Now, of course, it is important in our practice to have enough concentration where we all of a sudden see the emptiness of it all. We see the blue sky, nothing there at all. We really need to see that, you know. But if that is all we see, we're stuck. I did a koan with someone, it may have been you, it's a disease, the diseases of Zen, it's called. So there's all these different diseases that we have. And if we get stuck in one of those, we've got to be very careful. You know. So again, very important. So if we have the element of concentration without a moral sense of morality, and this is moral discrimination, wisdom doesn't arise. Those elements need to be there. Now, another thing I want to mention, and this comes back to the word introspection. There is a difference between introspection and conceptualization. When we conceptualize, and quite often when we do koan work in the Dokusan room, I might say, oh, that's a concept. And people misunderstand that when we say a word or we say something, that is automatically a concept. There is a fine difference, okay? A concept is when we speculate. A concept is when there is no wisdom behind it. There's no insight there. It is pure speculation. It is pure discrimination. You know, it is an overlay of the fact, of whatever it is. These are overlays, if you like. Now, what's introspection? Introspection is when we look at the fact, first we need to see the fact, whatever it is. We need to strip everything away and see it clearly. That needs to be presented in the Dokusan room. But then I ask questions, and people automatically interpret those questions as there must be concepts. I'm not asking for concepts. I'm asking for your wisdom. I want to see whether you have discerned what you're seeing. Have you really seen it? Can you see it? And that is not easy to articulate, but it can be articulated. But if you interpret as every word as being a concept, you never get to that point. But of course, it is really hard practice. So if you see a fact in a koan, if you see one thing in a koan, and I challenge you to see it in this koan as well, you've got to first find out what it is, then you've got to add something to it. But not a concept. That's just pure speculation. You've got to add your own wisdom, you know, so that you can articulate what you see. Of course, you go back into the relative world when you do that, you know. And there's nothing wrong with that. We need to come back to the relative world, you know. We are not stuck. We should never be stuck in the emptiness of it all, in the pure fact of it all. That's like being stuck in pure concentration without having any discernment whatsoever, you know. So all these things run. They intermingle. We've got to see that. Okay. So
I just wanted to make, just wanted to add that before I start on the koan. Okay, we start with introduction. Even if you sank forever in hell, you would not look for the liberation of saints. Even if you sank forever in hell, it's one of the best lines in this koan. Even if you sank forever in hell, you would not look for the liberation of saints. That takes some special person to be able to say that. Hell, you could also translate as, even if you are plagued with constant anxiety, even if you're plagued with physical discomfort, with poverty, whatever it is, whatever imagination we have about hell, you would not look for liberation of the saints. So liberation of the saints, of course, means salvation. You would not look for salvation. So again, imagine being having a state of mind where you are completely free. You no longer need any salvation. We're all looking to be saved somehow, and we think that maybe enlightenment is it. You know, there's this need of us to somehow need salvation. What? Someone to come and save us. Of course, in many traditions, it's God that saves us. We put it out there, someone that is out there saving us, or maybe Buddha comes in and saves us. So if you sank forever in hell, you would not look for the liberation of the saints. So forever in hell means forever. You know, like even if you were forever in hell, imagine, not just temporarily in hell, not purgatory from a Christian context, but forever in hell, you would not need someone. There's a story about this. I remember once meeting someone, a lady in India. I was at an Ayurvedic clinic in Kerala, actually. You're from Kerala. And Diana said, well, we have to go to this clinic. Anyway, I went with her to this Ayurvedic clinic. And it's 2 weeks, and it's quite excruciating for my part of view. But anyway, I decided that, oh, there's so many people that are into this sort of thing, you know, and I asked, anyone interested in meditation? We'll start meditating in a room at night. And there were quite a few people came to that. And I just started giving an introduction to meditation, and we had this little group starting to meditate. And this lady was there, an elderly lady, Heidi, and she was very quiet, but I could see she had some power in her sitting, you know. And I said to her at the end, oh, you've sat before? She said, yes, I've done Zen before. I said, oh, okay. And I said, oh, who did you sit with? Oh, he said, you wouldn't know. I sat with a Zen master called Yamada Koen Roshi in Kamakura, Japan. She said, and of course, he's our big master, you know. And she finished all her koan work with him. She was a contemporary of Rosalind Stone, and here she was in Kerala, in India, in this little zendo that we formed there, sitting quietly, not saying anything. And as it happened, she was the carer of Koen Yamada when he died. So he then became severely ill at one stage. She was a palliative nurse, and that was also her profession. She was a palliative nurse, and she cared for him until he died. Anyway, what was interesting, I had 2 weeks with her, and I asked her all sorts of questions, and I got all the inside gossip of what happened at that period when all the first generation Western monks came first to Japan and got taught as lay people in that zendo. Okay, it was very interesting to hear the stories. And one story she said was that there was competition between the Christian priests coming to learn Zen and the Buddhists. And they were both Westerners and, of course, Japanese people as well. And the Buddhists challenged the Christians all the time because they had their own funny views, you know. And there was always a little bit of competition like that. So, but there is this story, and it's actually in the commentary that Yamada Roshi made on this particular koan. He challenged the Christian quite often, and here's a good example. He challenged the Christian with this statement. He said, "Where is the kingdom of God?" He said, "Where is the kingdom of God?" he asked him. And then he said, "It's right in hell, right in hell." He said, because the Christian, of course, there's the heaven and there's hell, you know. And that for a Christian is you'd have to sit with that. That's right in hell. Okay, that's where the kingdom of God is, right in hell. And he said, are you able to respond, like in that first phrase, even if you sank forever in hell, you would not look for the liberation of all saints. That is what you need to get to. That is the Zen journey. If not, then your God, he said, is not all powerful. Then your God is not all powerful and almighty, you know. When I read this in his Taisho, this conversation I had with this lady, Heidi, in Kerala came back to me, and I thought, oh, that would have been really challenging for the Christians to hear that. But that's what it is, you know, this is what it is. So this is what that's just the first sentence, okay. Devadatta enjoyed the bliss of the Sirdhyana heaven amid uninterrupted hell. Okay. Now, Devadatta, who was Devadatta? Devadatta was the cousin of Buddha. Okay. Devadatta was the cousin of Buddha. And when you look at the Pali canon, you will find that there was always some animosity in regards to Devadatta towards the Buddha. Maybe you can call it competition, and it's quite open. And Devadatta became a follower of the Buddha. He was part of the Sangha, you know, the original Sangha. So he was a Sangha member of the Buddha, Buddha's Sangha. But he was continuously stirring, you know. And he was jealous in that Buddha had many people followed exactly what Buddha said, but they did not necessarily follow what Devadatta said. Okay. He got so jealous, in fact, that he tried to kill Buddha and start his own Sangha, so the story goes. Okay. And what he did is, as the Buddha was passing down a valley, he went up a hill and it dislodged a big rock and he let it fall onto Buddha. And the story goes that Buddha moved away, and it just that rock slightly touched him, but it drew blood. Okay, so the story goes. And of course, that is a really big sin in Buddhism, if you draw blood or if you hurt a Buddha. Okay. So as a punishment, he went to hell, Avidita hell, I think it's called, Avicii hell, which is the hell that you can never get out of again. So this is, of course, a story. So whether we believe that this has actually happened is another thing, that's up to you. But he went to hell, okay? And here in the sentence says, Devadatta enjoyed the bliss of the third dhyana. In other words, that's the third jhana level, as far as your different levels of concentration are concerned. Amid uninterrupted hell. So this is a good example of we can have concentration without any moral compass, without any moral, you know, without any moral and morality, if you like, and without any wisdom. So that's a good example of that. And just a little bit on Buddhist cosmology, because it goes into Buddhist cosmology. These different realms that we experience, it's called the realm of desire that we live in right now as human beings. And of course, there are those six worlds that are often depicted in Buddhist cosmology. And we can, of course, look at these realms as being really existing, okay, out there somewhere. Okay, and some people, especially, Buddhists that have been brought up that way, thinking that just like Christians believe that there is a hell and a heaven, they really believe that that exists, you know. And we can't discard it because ultimately we don't know. So if you don't believe that, which is understandable as Westerners, we don't believe in these realms of ghosts and heavens and all of that. It's arrogant to say, no, they don't exist either, because we ultimately don't know. Okay. And that's a good position to be in. We don't know. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I don't know. The other thing is, the other way to look at that is, well, the Buddha said so, and the Buddha certainly would not lie. So that's another, you know, people come with that argument, that Buddha would not lie. Therefore, I believe it, because I believe what the Buddha has said. That's my model. So I believe what the Buddha has said. Okay. Whether the Buddha has said it or not, we don't know, but we have to presume that he has, because there's so much evidence out there in the sutras, and it goes back so far, that we can look at it from that perspective. And then yet another perspective, as I keep on mentioning quite often, is when we look at the different realms as states of mind. Because when you look at it, the Buddha also was able to go from one realm to another, just like that. And quite frankly, so can we. If we just look at the realms from a perspective of our own mind, we can get into the hell realm just like that. You have an argument with your family or with your wife or anyone, like with your partner, and bang, you can be in hell realm. You know, all of a sudden you get the sack at work, and again, you can be in hell realm before you know it. Or you get angry, something triggers you. We can be in hell realm very quickly. The hungry ghost realm is the greed, that greedy realm. We cannot let go. We cannot constantly looking out for the dollar, constantly attaching to savings. Oh, I must keep it all. You know, you can see people that are hoarding. There are so many examples. Even people like tycoons, industrialists, they've got all the money in the world and it's never enough. That never enough. Insatiable hunger, that insatiability that we all have. That's the hungry ghost realm. That's that realm of greed. You know. Then you look at beast or animal realm. The beast or the animal realm, again, it's a realm that we can all... The beast and the animal realm is one of pure reaction without wisdom. You know, there's food and I gobble it down. You know, without, okay, let's just look at it, have a bit of gratitude. Just that pure reaction, you know. No empathy is another. That's another signal of an animal realm. Absolutely no empathy at all. Okay. So the other one is, of course, the human realm, which is supposed to be the one that we inhabit. Okay. What's the human realm? What's an idea of the human realm? We could say that it's a functional ego. We have a functional ego, but we're trapped in duality. We are trapped in our own convention. It's the chain that holds us. We are human, but there's still that chain there that keeps us bound. It's a human realm. Heavenly realm. The heavenly realm is a realm that maybe we are starting to break up that chain, those linkages. We are getting into some deeper states of seeing who we are, beyond the conditions, beyond our own conditioning, beyond these
these boundaries that we set for ourselves. We are starting to get into the heaven. We get a glimpse of the heavenly realm. Then there's the God realm. What's the God realm? The God realm is when we see it, when we have, you could say it's an awakened realm. That's the realm when we really see the emptiness of it all. But we're still bound by corporality. We're still bound by our body, So if you like, there is nirvana, paranirvana. Okay, so this is like when the body is completely gone. But we're still bound by conditionings. We can't help it. Even though we can access all of these realms. And we can go from one to the other, And the idea, when you hear the Buddha speak in the sutras, he was able, through his meditation, and this is a method of getting to those realms, and that's also in the canon, by the way, the method to get to the different realms is through meditation. Through meditations, if we have a clear eye, we can see where we are at. We can transmigrate through the different realms. We can see where we are at. So to me, anyway, that's a wonderful way where we can look at that Buddhist cosmology and recognize it in a modern context. Okay, so this was Devadatta enjoyed the bliss of the third dhyana heaven amid uninterrupted hell. Okay, so even though he was in hell, he still had the possibility of being in rapture, if you like, of being able to concentrate. Okay. And I guess the takeaway message from that is that Kensho is not enlightenment. Having an awakening experience or an opening is not enlightenment. You can have that and still be in hell, and still be deluded. So there are all these different, there's all these different aspects that we need to take into consideration. And this is very powerful. And that is why those three aspects I mentioned before, those three training methods, morality, concentration, and wisdom work together. Uddaka Ramputa fell from the zenith of heaven down into the body of an otter. Just tell me, where is the gain or loss? So Uddaka Ramaputta was a teacher of the Buddha. So the Buddha, before his enlightenment experience, had two teachers. Okay. So he left his home and he went and he contemplated life and death and suffering, impermanence, he the three marks of existence, if you like. He contemplated that and he tried to find a solution. Call it the Buddhist project. Okay. So the first teacher that he went to, his name was Alara Kalama, you've got to remember, in those days they had the Vedic, so there were lots of teachers that were already into meditation and their spirituality was already there, but through the Vedic traditions. And also Jainism was already prevalent as well at the time. So the Buddha went to this teacher and the teacher taught him as much as he could. The teacher realized, this is the first teacher, that the Buddha, was switched on, if I can say that. He was really good. And he said, why don't you stay with me? You have gone as far as you can. Why don't you stay with me and help me spread the word? And Buddha said, no, I have not gone far enough. He pushed himself further. He left that teacher. Then he met another teacher. That teacher brought him to another level. And that teacher is Uddaka Ramaputta. And again, the story goes that Uddaka Ramaputta recognized that the Buddha had even higher spiritual attainment than himself. And he was ready to pass on his entire student body to the Buddha. Said, please, you take it over. You are actually more awakened than I am. That's what he's, according to the story, that's what he said to the Buddha. And again, it takes some humility from the teacher's point of view, But also, the other takeaway from this is too, the student must surpass the teacher. That's the task of a student in clarity. You know, the student must surpass the teacher. That is your task. You know, otherwise, it dies down. You know, we always must strive towards that. The student must surpass the teacher. You know, that is the goal in clarity, in attainments. Yeah. So Buddha surpassed Udaka Ramaputta. Okay. But again, the Buddha refused. And he said, no, I need to practice more. I'm not ready yet to teach. Yeah. And so he kept on practicing. Okay. Then he had his enlightenment experience. After he had his enlightenment experience, the story goes that he thought no one will understand it. And he went to heaven and the gods told him that, yes, there are people with very little dust in their eyes. Go down and teach to them to get to that next level, if you like. And the Buddha thought of Udaka Ramaputta at that instance, you know. So anyway, that's the story. So that's the background. So Udaka Ramaputta fell from the zenith of heaven down into the body of an otter. He fell from the zenith of a heaven down into the body of an otter. Just tell me, where is the gain or loss? So we have those two things. We've got hell, okay, someone being blissfully in hell, the cousin of Buddha, and we've got Udaka Ramaputta being at the zenith of heaven. He was right there in heaven, and he fell right down again into the realm of an animal, an otter. And then the question is, tell me, where is the gain and where is the loss? Okay. Now comes introspection. How do you look at that? Where is the gain? Where is the loss? We can conceptualize it and you can write a thesis about it. You know, where is the gain and where is the loss? But we need now wisdom to look at gain and loss. What is gain and loss? How can someone be in hell and experience bliss? And how can someone be in heaven and come right down back into the world of animals, if you like, or the world of just reaction? That requires introspection, you know, to do that. And of course, we have methods, like mindfulness is a method. So I'll give you one example, gain and loss. You know, if you look at gain and loss, when that question comes up, where is gain and loss? If you have the eye, if you had an experience, you see straight away that gain and loss is nothing but a concept. There's no such thing as gain and loss. Gain and loss is determined by a formula. A formula determines gain and loss. What is that formula? That formula is a convention that I have accepted. Nothing but that. But a formula is not real. It's just something I have adopted. That is a formula. You know, that is gain and loss. Once I let go of that formula, oh, man, there's no gain, there's no loss, there's no heaven, there's no hell. There's nothing there. The reason is there's a hell there is because I made it, because I believed in the formula. There is no hell. And when you see that, all of a sudden the koan opens up, it's like, oh man, how stupid could I have been to believe in this? That's koan introspection. And you can say that to the teacher. That's not conceptualization. That is insight. Gain and loss. Gain is a story that I have. Loss is a story that I have. Let go of opinions, let go of stories, and it disappears. But of course, when I need it, I can access it. That's right, that's wrong. If you say to your child, don't go in that swimming pool without anyone there, and they do it, there's consequences to be had. You can't just say there's no gain or loss if your child drowns. Of course not. We adopt conventions for a reason. We don't let them just go. At the same time, there's no such thing. There's just boundaries that I set up in order to function as a human being. That's it. So this is this. Udaka Raputa fell from the zenith of heaven down into the body of an otter. Just tell me, where is the gain and loss?
Now, when we first read this, it's like, oh God, and you turn the page. But go into it. You know, it's hard because, you know, I remember a lecturer in the Buddhist class, you know, especially when he's talking about reading sutras, he always said it's really difficult to read sutras because our mind is used to reading in a certain way, and that is very quick comprehension. If we don't comprehend very quickly, then we automatically discard it, too difficult, and we go to the next thing that is easier. Okay, it's almost like there's effort required and a bit of research. There's effort required to slowly read and to let it sink in and to dwell on it, you know. And again, this is koan work. This is the work that koan, and they all point always to that. They point to something, okay, which you need to present. Okay, so now let's get to the case. When Uncle Mishi and Tozan were walking together, they saw a white rabbit run by in front of them. Mishi said, "How swift!" Tozan said, "In what way?" So Uncle Mishi, by the way, uncle in, you know, this is, he's a Dharma uncle. Okay, so a Dharma uncle, so if you know, those of you that know Zen know that it's based on the lineage. So my Dharma father was my teacher. My teacher's fellow students, if you like, were his brother and sister. Okay, my fellow students were my fellow students when I was a student are my Dharma brothers and sisters, but my teacher's fellow students are my uncles and aunties. So Uncle Leah, those that know Leah, is my auntie, you know, if you like. So this is what that's referred to. When Uncle Mishi is a Dharma uncle, and he was always referred to as Uncle Mishi, according to the text. And Tozan, the Soto tradition, Tozan was one of the founders of Soto. So To is the That stands for To, it's for Soto. Zozan was the first, and Tozan together created the Soto tradition. So Soto, To, Tozan, okay? So a very famous master. Okay, so here we have this dialogue. When Uncle Mishi and Tozan were walking together, they saw a white rabbit run in front of them. Mishi said, "How swift." Okay, let's just stick to that, how swift. That's it. That, you know, that's a day-to-day throwaway line. Like, gee, did you see that? Well, whew, it's a bit cold. It's just one of those things we say. It's nothing more than that. Okay. Or there's someone at the door. Just like that. How swift? Okay. Really throwaway line. And again, this is something now you've got to discern what to pick out in a koan as being really valuable and go into that. And then Tozan said, "In what way?" That's a typical Zen thing. So "in what way" is like, okay, let me see if he really sees it. Let me see if he, you know, like typical, you know, let me see if they get it. You know, this is not easy, but this is quite difficult, you know, especially in a statement like that. It's the same with a monk asked Joshua, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West? What's the meaning of this guy coming into? What's the meaning of Buddhism? An oak tree in the garden." "Oh, what do you mean, an oak tree in a garden? Do you get it?" You know, it's the same thing. How swift? Now he's challenging him. Tozan is challenging Uncle Mishi. How so? Do you really see it? What is it? And that is what you've got to present in the Dokusan room. You've got to present if what you see. And there's first the presentation, meaning you've got to see the fact stripped of everything else. And then you've got to see the wisdom, whether you really see what that actually is. Otherwise, you're just repeating what someone else has said, maybe. Or you're speculating, you're guessing. And that might, you may have heard enough that you come up with the right answer. But you really got to, you got to look at, what am I getting out of this? What is it in there that I can see? That is not easy. And that process of really digging into it is wisdom practice. That is insight practice. That is vipassana practice. Dig into that. Find out what it is. Try and articulate it. And then Mishi said, so his answer to that challenge is, it's just like a person in white clothes being venerated by a prime minister. What a strange thing to say. It's just like a person in white clothes being venerated. It's like saying, if you translate into Australian, it's just like a person with high-vis clothes being venerated as Anthony Albanese. Nowadays, a bit different. It'll be just Anthony Albanese putting on, you know, a hard hat to be venerated as a commoner. You know? Yeah. You can play it either way. Okay. So that is his response. Okay. So, of course, you know, it's like you can speculate. You know, you could speculate on that sentence. Like that's when you look at the metaphor. There's different metaphors here that you can get out of it. Like, for instance, it's just like someone that is delusional all of a sudden getting it. All of a sudden being awakened. That's one way you can speculate. And usually, because we're dealing with a koan, it always relates to something. Okay. So it's just like someone that is delusional and all of a sudden being awakened. You know, I always say, in Zen we say there's always been that debate between gradual enlightenment and sudden enlightenment. Let me give you a secret. It is gradual until it becomes sudden. You know, that's what happens. Just like that. But there is a process involved for just like that to happen. But just like that needs to happen. Okay. So, okay, anyway, there are different ways you can look at that. And again, something for the Dokusan room, okay, without falling too much into concepts. Okay. Now, Tozan, in reply, said, you are such an elderly and respectable man. In other words, you've come so far in your practice. You are such an elderly and respectable man, and still you talk like that? That gives you already a clue. And still you talk like that? You know, like, oh my gosh, if you said that, what is this? And it's just like a venerated, it's just like a commoner being venerated as prime minister. Most Zen teachers would ring the bell, come again, bring me another. A presentation that's not good enough. And this is him ringing the bell in a way, Tozan. You are such an elderly and respectable man, and still you say something like that. So again, a challenge, another challenge towards Mishi, Uncle Mishi. So he's almost saying that he's, you know, there's a rabbit, how swift, then the answer is like adding salt to a perfectly good meal. You know, he didn't nail it. He did not see what he actually said he saw. He did not see it from that perspective. He hasn't had clarity on what he actually said. He had no clarity on it. It was just a throwaway line. He didn't see it. Okay. Now Mishi wasn't gonna let that go. Mishi said, okay then, how would you say it? You know, he threw it right back at Tozan. How about you? You know, and Tozan said, a noble of an ancient house is temporarily fallen into poverty. A noble of an ancient house is temporarily fallen into poverty. Okay, so what do you make of this sentence? Okay. Again, different ways that we can interpret this. A noble of an ancient house could refer to Mishi, Uncle Mishi. A noble. So you're a noble, you know, you've been practicing for a long time. You're part of the family, Zen family. You're part of a noble house of Zen, you know. But you've fallen into poverty. You've fallen into the delusions. You've fallen into the world of duality. You've fallen into the relative world, okay, with your comment. Again, this is not cut and dry. This is something that we all need to somehow get a sense of. What is it that he actually said? Okay. But remember in this koan, what is the main point? The main point is, and I'll give that away here, how swift. That is the main point of the koan. You know. And all of these answers, quite frankly, they don't cut it. You know, this is why this is seen as a very weak koan, because those answers are conceptual. Those answers fall within the realm of teachings rather than actually demonstrating what it is really about. You parallel this with oak tree in the garden. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West? The oak tree in the garden, there is a day and night difference between those two, you know. But again, this is, you know, this is something that students need to discern for themselves. Okay. So I wait until you get to this koan and present me how swift when we get to that point. Now the verse. Matching strength with snow and frost, walking smoothly upon elevated cloud. So what that refers to, it's not easy to matching strength with snow and frost. Keep in mind we're talking ancient China here, so snow and frost is a quite predominant weather condition. Matching, here we could say matching strengths with heat and sweat. That would be more Aussie. You know, matching strengths with heat and sweat. You know, in other words, the world of suffering. So there's strengths with, it's matching, you know, that's what that refers to. The world of suffering, or if you like, the phenomenal world. You know, there's one world, the dualistic world is another way of looking at it, if you want to add another concept to that. Walking smoothly upon elevated clouds. That's the other side. When you've seen the world of oneness, then walking smoothly upon elevated clouds. You've let all of that go. You are in another dimension. You're in the God realm. You know, there is, you've let go of all of these hells. Even in hell, you don't see hell. It's just, everything is just clouds. Everything is walking smoothly. So this is a nice way of sort of showing these two worlds. Nirvana, samsara. That's what this refers to. Okay. Now, there are four lines here which are quite difficult, but they are, again, you really need to research this in order to get to this. They're not really that important, but just to give you, they are just examples. Let's take them as examples. So Xue, or whatever his name is, Xia Hui left his country. Okay, so the story is that he's a, you know, in ancient China, he's a legend, and he was so honest that his honesty got him into trouble. He was uncorruptible, he worked for the government, and he was so honest, and he was sacked three times because of his honesty, because he pushed too many buttons. Radical honesty cannot work in a system of government. You know, we know that just by looking at the news. If you are totally honest with everyone, you can't be, because there are too many conflicting interests. We expect our politicians to be absolutely honest. It's impossible. You know, not only won't they get elected if they're honest, but there are so many conflicting aspects, it's impossible to be like that. And also they cannot possibly know everything. It is so interconnected. He was so honest that he got the sack. And quite frankly, if you had a politician that was, they wouldn't last long. It just would not last long, you know. So this is one example. The next one, Xiangru passed the bridge. So here's an example of another legendary figure of humble beginnings, went over the bridge and decided right there and then, I'm going to come back over that same bridge to my hometown with a chariot. In other words, I'm going to come back a rich man. So this is your classical success story, okay? So I'm really poor, and I'm going to come back, and I'm going to show them all, and I'm going to be really rich, okay? There's another story. Then another one is Xiao Cao's strategy established the Han Dynasty. So you've got two figures here. One came with 3,000 troops to get in there, and this other guy instigated a revolution. And together, those two parts were instrumental in creating the Han Dynasty, according to what I've been reading and researching. Okay, it's a little bit like today, the Wagner group, you know, comes in, and then you've got the generals in Russia, and they're all trying to get Ukraine,
And for all you know, if they're going to win, they're going to create a new name and it's going to call another dynasty. And you say those two established, for better or worse, whatever new Soviet Union, whatever it's going to be called. You know, it's a similar example to that. Then there's one more example. The body and mind of Chao and Zhu wanted to evade Emperor Yao. That's a really odd one, because apparently Chao was told he would be emperor one time by the emperor, and he thought that was a really bad omen to be told that. Okay, so he was, and of course a lot of Chinese, as we know, are very suspicious of these sorts of things. So he went to the river and washed his ears. Yeah, didn't hear that. Like putting your head in the sand, like an ostrich, you know. And someone saw him washing his ears and said, oh, that's not good. So he took away all his bullocks because they shouldn't drink from that water, because there must have been some real demonic stuff coming out of his ears because he washed them clean. So he didn't want to get his bullocks he didn't want to get his bullocks contaminated. So that, again, suspicious, you know. There's another story. So you got these four stories. What have they got to do with the koan? That comes in the next line. You've got to see that. When you first look at these, it's hard to get your head around this. Okay. The next line is, people are disturbed by favor and disgrace. Find deep faith in yourself. And that's what it is. We are disturbed by favor and disgrace. It doesn't matter whether someone is honest and you get the sack, or you're rich and people don't give you any credit for it, or you're poor and you get vilified. Favor and disgrace happen every day, all the time. We, again, if we follow a formula, the formula of our convention, even the formula of right and wrong, whatever formula it is we choose to have, we're going to get disturbed. So the key is not anarchy, throw away every formula. The key is look at what underlies all of that, our true self. Who am I beyond that formula? Find deep faith in yourself. Yourself as in I alone. Your true self. Who you are beyond all these formulas, once you let go of all of that, that's what this is pointing to. And the last line, the traces of the true heart get mingled and mixed with those of fishermen and woodcutters. That's the faces of the true heart get mingled. In other words, we come back to the marketplace amongst the fishermen and woodcutters. This comes back to the ideals. You can no longer do wrong. In other words, your roots are so deep and you've seen where they come from. Regardless of what happens to the tree as it swings in the wind, you're stable. This is one way of looking at that. But it's just beautiful. The traces of the true heart get mingled and mixed. That's the phenomenal world. That's the samsaric world. They get mingled and mixed. If we don't have clarity, we just blow with the wind every which way, and it hurts. But if we have a true heart, we see that we get mingled and mixed, but we can stay stable. And that, another word for that is equanimity. That's why we practice.